Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. Let's do a podcast. You guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, March 20th, 2016. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on iTunes and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. It would be good to know. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival, and you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 161 of the show. I have a very special guest, a man by the name of Thomas Attila Lewis. You've heard me mention him a bunch of times, and I sat down and I talked to him, and you're going to get that evidence of that conversation in a few minutes. I got a couple things to say. Right now, I'm in my fallout shelter of an apartment. If my mom saw how this looked, she would murder me on site. But I just have not been, and I haven't been. I just sleep here for the past few months, and so I'm never really home. And when I'm home, I'm just trying to recover from it, recover from my busy life, you guys. So I gotta clean this fucking place up. Right now, I have what's going on in my life now. I'm in the midst of the weekend of working with Craig Robinson of The Office fame, Hot Tub Time Machines 1 and 2. And he's going to be on season 2 of Mr. Robot. Working with him at Levity Live. This has to be one of the best weekends I've had being an MC. All the shows are pretty much sold out. Saturday was sold out. We got one more tonight, and I think that's sold out too. He's just a fun dude, really chill. Actually reminds me of one of my college roommates, just like a really chill, really nice dude, really fun guy, all around good dude, man. And so I enjoy, really been enjoying working with this dude. I'll post some pictures maybe on the gram so you guys can see it. But he's a really cool dude, and I'm having fun working with him. Rob Cantrell was featuring this weekend. He's also very cool and chill dude. Gonna have to try to lock Rob down and get him on the pod. So many people that I want to have on the show. So that's that. And then back to reality on Monday. I'll probably be doing laundry or something. Maybe I'll buy a pair of jeans. How about that, guys? Right now I have Being Mary Jane, the series, on pause. The Gabrielle Union show. It's pretty good. I'm only I got 12. Netflix is telling me I have 12 minutes left on episode 2, and it's pretty fun. It's just like a kind of soapy comedy. It's pretty good, and it's on BET. I didn't know they let you say cum on BET. BET, I didn't know they let you do that, but I don't know if they bleeped it out on the show, but they sure said it on this episode that I'm looking at. Not like I'm trying to sound like a Puritan. It's a little jarring to hear it from a BET show, but whatever. I will give you what else? I'll give you a movie review. I just finished watching this movie that I wanted to see for quite some time, ever since I heard about it. This movie called The Program, which is kind of like I wouldn't say it's a full-on biopic, but it's about Lance Armstrong, and it's about the journalist David Walsh of the Sunday Times, who investigated Lance Armstrong for doping. And Ben Foster plays Lance Armstrong, and Chris O'Dowd plays David Walsh. And I always forget this dude's name every time I see his face. He's like He's on Breaking Bad and Friday Night Lights. That's so bad. I'm usually really good at that. So I hate Jesse Plemons, who played Floyd Landis, the guy that he got caught for doping, and then he just dropped a gem on everybody. But Ben Foster really kills it as Lance Armstrong. He's just like, it's pretty much a pitch perfect, unflinching performance. You know, like he does show a little bit of, there's a few scenes where he shows some vulnerability, but for the most part, he's just an asshole. And it's kind of like, I think Bill Burr touched on this. I don't know if he did it in his, I don't remember if he did it on his, in his stand up or just on like Conan or his podcast, but all those dudes were doping, and it made you, at the top of the film when Lance was starting out, it was like, yeah, you know, some rider was like, you're never going to beat those dudes in front of you because they're all taking XYZ drugs and all that stuff. But it was a good movie. It's playing, if you're in New York City, it's playing at the, I think it's playing at the AMC Empire 25, but it's on video on demand, and I just bought it from the PlayStation store. It was about $16. I figured if I were to go into New York City, it would be, you could pay $15 to cross the GWB. That's the George Washington Bridge, for those of you that don't know. But you pay about $14 to do that, and then you pay for parking, and then you go to the movie. Then you're going to want, what I usually do, I don't go too crazy with the concessions. I usually do the peanut M&Ms and a Dasani. That's usually how I roll, a large Dasani. So that's what I do. So I was like, you know what? Let me just, I'll buy it. Because the homie Andrew Short was telling me, like, you know, I'm trying to come around to be this digital media cool guy. So that's what I'm doing. So I did like this movie. You don't have to buy it, you know what I'm saying? But if you, I think you can rent it for like $8. That's the cost of a movie ticket. But I did like it. The acting's good, and it's directed by Stephen Frears, and this is from the team that brought you, I believe, The Queen, The Theory of Everything, and Philomena. So it's good. It's well produced. It's a good looking movie. I recommend it, and I'm sure, I think it premiered on DirecTV, and then they released it on VOD. So I would say definitely check this out. And that is the movie review segment. And we're just going to get you to Tom Attila Lewis. Thomas Attila Lewis. I like to call him Tom. Yeah, Tom, I met Tom a couple of years ago at Levity Live. And I think it was like just a weeknight where Paul Verzey was doing a headlining set. And I was on the show, and I think Keenan Weaver was on the show. Got to get him on the show. Got to get him on the pod. And talk some video games and shit. But so he was on the show, and we're just hanging out, and he's the producer of the My Dumb Friends podcast with Sean Donnelly and Dan St. Germain. That's on iTunes and Stitcher and all that good stuff. It's a really good podcast. I would say that show's definitely appointment listening. They have guests most of the time, but the fun part about that show is the relationship between Dan and Sean, and then you throw Tom in the mix. It's a good time. So definitely check My Dumb Friends out. And I met Tom, and we just stayed in touch, and He's a special person to me because he's one of the first people to headline me out of town. I had done the breakout show at Caroline's a couple years back, and then a few months later, he asked me to headline out in for the 10x10 Comedy Festival out in the Berkshires in Pittsville, Mass. And that was a great time. And he booked me on the High Mud Comedy Festival. And like I said, like that the Berkshires is a beautiful place. And it's somewhere that I would like to at least perform there once a year, God willing. And he also runs a show with Ethan Ullman at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady, New York. Did that in January, did a spot on that show, and it's just a really fun show. He's a really good dude, funny guy, really cares about comedy and the way it's presented. You know, I kind of call, for the theater nerds, for the movie nerds, I would call him a more well-adjusted Corky St. Clair. And I've told him this to his face, so don't think it's a diss. But he's an endearing Corky St. Clair. I don't think that's a diss. You know, I don't think it's a diss. I think it's nice. He's a good dude, and we had a really good conversation. We did it in my room at the Porches Inn, and we do get a phone call like towards the end where the hotel is low key trying to kick us out because we went a little past my checkout time. But then I was like, oh, sorry, we stayed long. They were like, no, we weren't trying to kick you guys out. We just wanted to see if you were okay. That AKA, get the fuck out of the hotel room. But shout out to the Porches Inn. They're really nice, and I had a great time. And this is actually, I would say, this is the, other than the Pete Dominic episode, this is a time, an episode where there's no noise except the phone call, and we're just hanging out and talking. And this is I think this episode could have gone longer. I think Tom rivals Jason Lawhead in my appreciation of, you know, like there's just some people that you just like to listen to them talk. You just set them up with a question and they go on and on, but it's not boring, but it's still an engaging. But I just like listening to this guy talk, and he's got a lot of knowledge on a lot of different things. And this could have went longer, but I'll just probably have him on again. But no one has beat Jason Lawhead in episode length as of yet. I think maybe Greg Howard did. Greg Howard might have beat Jason Lawhead. But anyway, so this episode, I would say, was, this conversation was great. There was it took a turn where I didn't know it would where it would go. It was interesting. It was very, Tom opened up on some real shit, and I hope you enjoy this, because I had a really great time. So this is my conversation with Thomas Attila Lewis, comedian and father. So we're first episode in a while.
Okay.
Where we're hanging out, and there's nobody to interrupt. There's no loud music going on.
Right.
So it's good, man.
Clanging of plates and people yelling in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. It's always this. I have to say, I've told you this before. The Berkshires are probably, this is my favorite place.
Yeah.
Like, to do stand up in my limited career.
Yes.
As an up and coming unknown comedian, I would say this is probably my favorite place.
Yeah, it's been fun producing shows here for the last few years. Mm-hmm. And because I always felt like there was kind of a need for it.
Yeah.
Being a fan of comedy my whole life and going to see stand-up since I was like 13 years old. Living in the Berkshires, it was just kind of weird because there's no comedy club.
Mm-hmm.
The nearest club is kind of over in Albany, and it's, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the place. And mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, there should be something here.
Yeah.
There's a couple kind of theater places in the Berkshires, you know, that are like 600 seat theater spaces.
Right.
But that's not like a club either, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those shows are good, but you know, it's you know, unless you put down like whatever the $45 or $60 to be kind of in the orchestra section,
right,
you could be a couple levels up, you know. And it's, there's just kind of like, I wanted to have shows with a bit more intimacy, so that's why I started doing shows. And so I guess like 3-4 years now, I've been, three something years doing shows really consistently. And I didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
You know, with them. And people are coming out and supporting them, and it's you know, I get to expose friends and you know, comics who've been friendly with me, who mm-hmm. I've seen perform, and like, you know, who are people who are good people, you know, like that's always been like a way to be successful. It's like, oh, is this person a good person?
Right, right.
And then I try to be as good a person as I can be, so then you get a good you get a good reputation.
Right.
Because, you know, I work with people, like, you know, they might have a manager or agent, but I try to work directly with them.
Sure.
You know, and you know, get a good word of mouth and a recommendation from somebody else of like, go do his show. Or I work with like my co-producer Ethan over in Albany on stuff, and you know, we have a good reputation and people get treated well and we have a good crowd for them, and it's, you know, the venues that are kind of home venues are very supportive, and the crowds are supportive, so it's been good. You know, I mean, I did an open mic for 2.5 years. I have a new one now, but then about, I don't know, 6-8 months into running the open mic, I started doing kind of whatever you call them, pro shows,
mm-hmm.
You know, paid shows, and you know, they've done pretty good for the most part, and it's always funny. Even like my open mics, we get a lot of civilians at them. My new one is a monthly, and it took me a while to convince the owner of this place to think about, like, you know, it took like a year, sure. Like from the first time we talked to when we did a show.
Is this the coffee house show?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Dottie's Coffee Lounge in Pittsfield. And, you know, she was cautious and she didn't know me very well. And I got her to a couple of my produced shows and my pro shows. And she's like, okay, you know, let's try doing that. And she's been nothing but great since then. And we've done a pro show there, and we're going to be doing them every other month in the same space. But, you know, the open mics, we have like 40, like 50 civilians coming to an open mic.
And that, you know? And to me, that's essentially a show.
Right.
Anywhere right. And I say this about my buddies, Randolph Terrence, Andy Klein, Tim Miller. They have this podcast called The Three Guys On Podcast, but mm-hmm. they run a room at the Arlington Draft House.
Yeah.
And Saturdays are their big open mic.
Right, right.
That's a show. Yeah. Like, that's a show. Yeah, you may test your new material, but you have to be on your game.
Right.
Because those people are there to see a show. It's not like, and if that was anywhere in New York City, if it was a bar show,
yeah,
it would be one of the top shows in the right. city.
Right.
Because it's real people coming. And I think the joy, the pleasure that I get out of coming to a place like this is because you do kind of toil away in New York City in these basements and
right.
and back rooms, and then you really get to get a gauge on how this material really lands, because there's right. people that are, you know, there was like last night, there was just like this electricity because there were people that were there to see a show. Like
yeah.
they weren't surprised. There was no surprise attack.
Right, right.
And they weren't, you know, they were ready. You
yeah.
know, so you have to deliver, and you have to rise to that level and rise to that occasion. So
yeah,
yeah.
It's been you know, so that's been really, you know, a lot of fun doing that. And then it seems like that this core of people that are coming to that every month are willing to come out, you know, and put some money down,
mm-hmm.
You know, every other month is yeah. what it looks like, and selling the room out for that. So, you know, and that's a bit smaller space than what I do over in Albany, which.
I talked about the Proctors on the show.
Yeah.
How many were there last night?
At the show.
At the main stage.
Main stage show, Mass Mocha. Well, that room holds 600.
Uh-huh.
And it was more than half full.
Okay.
So, I mean, I did see some empty seats, but it was a, you know, Friday night show in the Berkshires. You know, like, you always have to, like, oh, in, you know, always a add on in the Berkshires.
Yeah.
Because it's a tough, that's a more difficult night than Saturdays for whatever reason. But it was, I'd say, 3/4 full, 2/3 full, you know, for 6 times. So like 400 people in there. So.
It felt like a vibe, because I didn't get to see this stage or the space really until I got out there.
Right.
And it was just like, I was like, oh, okay. This is like, this is real. This is the real deal.
Yeah. I mean, since I moved here, I've been to, this place opened, Mass Mocha opened like a year before I moved here.
Okay.
And like in 2000 or something like that. And then, I mean, I've been coming here for, you know, multiple events per year, mm-hmm. you know, as a patron.
Right.
To check him out.
Patron of the arts.
You know, I'm not always like the most massive fan of the some of the contemporary and conceptual art that they do.
Okay.
Sometimes it's like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, okay, yeah, so it's a line on the wall that goes for 100 yards. You know, it's like...
Yeah, good, that's almost anything now, though.
Right. I get you have an idea, but, you know, it's not something...
Well, I want you to explain the Berkshires to me the listeners. So, like, explain that, and then... I want you to do that, but then maybe talk about Mass Mocha and what type of place it is.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and we'll go from there.
Well, the Berkshires, it's Western Mass.
Mm-hmm.
This is the westernmost county in Massachusetts, and it's the largest on-land county in Massachusetts. I think, like, the Cape and the Islands is bigger, but they draw a line around all the water, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, wait a minute, that's not fair. It's the least populated.
Okay.
County. So it's kind of rural. You know, there's a river that goes down for most of the county, the Housatonic River, and along that river, that's where mills started to appear in the 19th century. So it was like a farming community for a long time. And what's weird, you know, like Eastern Mass doesn't even know that we exist out mm-hmm. here. You know, and you can tell because we don't get, we have like a negative return on our tax money.
Okay.
Like it's just, all the money goes into Boston and it's almost all spent in Boston. And it's kind of frustrating. And I don't know, I think there's like the history with that is that people came into the Berkshires, they didn't come from Boston to the Berkshires. They mm-hmm. came up into the Berkshires from Connecticut because that was easier. Like there's these mountain ranges here.
Yeah.
There was no east-west road where you could take a wheeled vehicle until, you know, like almost 1900, right? You could take a horse,
mm-hmm.
but these mountains, like you couldn't bring a cart. So all trade and everything went like south down the river like into Connecticut, you know, and that's how you did it. It was easier to get over into New York, so they had more trade and stuff over into New York. My house, I live in Pittsfield. My house is on West Street. You know, it's very great. You know, easy names. There's North Street, South Street, East Street, West Street. I'm on West Street, and it used to be the Pittsfield-Albany Road.
Okay.
And it's an old farmhouse. My house was built in 1745. And the road, you know, went across and was the direct trade route to Albany. And
is how far? So are we about 18 miles from Pittsfield, something like that?
No, we're like about 25 miles from Pittsfield.
And so how far is Pittsfield from Albany?
Pittsfield to Albany is on the current, like, you know, if you take the highway, mm-hmm. when you take a state route 20 to the interstate, it's probably like 35 miles.
Okay.
Like that,
yeah.
Without that. I mean, I can get into downtown Albany from my house in 30 minutes or so,
35
minutes.
I was amazed at how close stuff was. Like, I didn't realize, when I did your show at Proctor's, I was in Albany, and it was really just like 15, 20 minutes away.
Yeah, it's really, it's much closer there than to go, you know, to Springfield, Massachusetts, or mm-hmm. Boston, or you know, I mean, Boston's 2 hours and 10 minutes away.
From here?
From Pittsfield. From here, it's another half hour, because you have to get down to the Mass Pike from here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's like, the farther you get from the Mass Pike, the longer everything takes. You're on state routes, like today, coming up to meet with Chris, I got stuck behind some people in a horse trailer, who had a horse trailer that was going, you know, that was full of horses, and it was going like half the speed limit. And then I got stuck behind some tourists who were like hitting the brakes and looking around. And actually, so when the season, there's all these different seasons here.
Right.
You know, the we're doing the High Mud Comedy Festival because it's, we're in mud season, that kind of transition from winter to spring.
Oh, okay.
When the ground thaws and you have your boots on, and you know, that's why the festival's called that.
Okay.
But it's also mapling season, so every weekend people are going to these Sugar Shack maple houses to eat stacks of pancakes, and there's one just to the west of us here, and then there's like, you're on the Mohawk Trail, and like every 5-10 miles are these Sugar Shacks, and that's what everybody does Saturday and Sunday, is they drive out and they eat themselves sick on maple syrup, and you know, Saturday and Sunday, and it's crazy. So
it's close to Vermont, right? How far are we from
Vermont? Yeah, Vermont is like, you know, like, we went out the back of this hotel, and like threw a rock, Vermont's right there.
Oh,
like, Vermont is like, not even, if we walked like a mile that direction in the woods, Vermont's right there.
Oh shit, okay.
Yeah, yeah, and then New York is about 8 miles to the to the west from here.
There's something that's kind of like, I don't know, there's something that I really like small town America. There's something still appealing about it.
Right.
Like, granted, like, you know, I don't know. It's just like this, where we're at now, the Porch is in, is something like cozy about it and warm.
Right, right.
And it's just the people here, just meeting different people that are, they're just like everybody else. It's just, so it's just, I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know. Small town America kind of gets shit on.
Well, I mean, this used to be a much bigger town. Like, that's the thing, is like all those mills kind of came about in the late 19th century. I mean, I joked at the beginning of the show last night that I was hosting, you know, well, what do people do for fun around here? And one of the things was, you know, they go into the Hoosick Tunnel, which is this train tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And it made the first east-west route for trains. That didn't happen until 1875. And they had it's a 4.75 mile tunnel through the mountain, and I don't know how many guys died building this tunnel. It took them 5-6 years to dig this hole, you know,
Jesus
through
Christ.
There, you know, and that, because there's a, so, you know, but the, that's what kind of got the mills going, and then, you know, all the train routes and all this kind of stuff, of course, came up from New York. They weren't going out towards Boston. But there were multiple train routes up through the Berkshires that went down to New York City, and then just over the border into New York, and so the mills got built up. There were textile mills.
Yeah,
Pittsfield had like one of the biggest breweries in the Northeast, and then they got to more sophisticated stuff. Well, they had paper. Paper is still a big deal in the Berkshires. We have Crane and Company here, and they make all kinds of specialty papers. And the big deal is in Dalton, which is right next to Pittsfield. That's, you're like, what's the deal with these plants? Like razor wire around these plants. You're like, what is going on? And you'll see the, like these weird kind of government vehicles. And it's Secret Service. Why is there Secret Service here? Well, Secret Service guards our currency, and all of the currency paper in the United States is made in Dalton by Crane. So like, you, every bill that you have in your hand is printed on paper made in the Berkshires, so they've had the contract for like 150 years to make that.
So paper mill was the industry. Now, like, I noticed, because we were talking last night about this isn't a Rust Belt city,
right?
But it's just, it reminded me of the little, in my travels, just knowing like Bethlehem, Pennsylvania,
right.
The steel mill,
sure,
and there's an art space there, but you could still see the steel stacks and everything. So what was Mass Mocha? What did Mass Mocha, what did they take over? What type of,
well, they, like, so that the sophistication went up with these places with in their production. So they Pittsfield started, they had like really sophisticated clockworks. Mm-hmm. You know, they're making these very high end clocks. And the kind of machinations that you had to do for that. And they started investing in kind of research stuff. There are a couple couple of these factories there that started working on that more and more, and they became GE, like part of like General Electric.
Okay.
Is what they did, and they were making. It's crazy all the different stuff they were making there. One of the things that they made there, kind of related to what's here in North Adams, they invented the transformer there. That, you know, you when you drive by telephone poles hanging on the pole, is that weird bucket thing, and that converts direct current to alternating current. You know, coming into your house, there's direct current on the power lines, and then they have to convert it to alternating. Into your house, and to do that they have this transformer thing, and it has to handle surges in power without blowing up everything in your house.
Yeah.
So they invented them there, and up here in Pittsfield, I'm sorry, up here in North Adams, they had Sprague Electric, which they also focused kind of on electricity and electronics, and they worked on capacitors which and transistors and that kind of thing, used in heavy equipment like power stations to military equipment and and that kind of thing. And Pittsfield, kind of the same, you know, kind of the same thing. I mean, Pittsfield, I think they had the largest, and they just tore it down like a year ago, but the largest artificial lightning building. So they would bring in objects and equipment and just zap them with the biggest bolt of lightning, like that could be generated, you know, however many million volts. And then they would, you know, Sprague Electric would send equipment down there. They were testing it. They were testing military equipment in that. It was this big metal box on the near the factory that they were just zapping the hell out of things with. But, you know, with all that, this stuff, you know, I mean, like, there was plenty of wealth. I mean, Pittsfield had crazy like department stores. Pittsfield is a county seat, so that's why I keep going back to it.
Sure.
It was the biggest town, and you know, it's where the like the judiciary was, and you know, your regional representatives. It was all based out of Pittsfield.
So why can't they keep a Best Buy?
Exactly. Right. So the Pittsfield, I mean, General Electric employed like 25,000 people.
Wow.
Like, that's how many employees they had.
Yeah.
Okay. And they pushed out all the other businesses. Like, okay. So they were the biggest employer, and they didn't want competition for their workers. So all the city council members, the mayor, were all handpicked by GE executives.
Mm.
Okay, you had like Jack Welch came from Pittsfield. I mean, he wasn't born in Pittsfield, but he made his career.
What years are we talking?
We're talking like from the 50s,
on.
You know, up into the 80s. You know, it was just, you know, one company town kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was very wealthy. I mean, there was, you know, these high-end department stores that had, you know, well, where are the stores located for these high-end chains? Like Englund Brothers and a couple of these others. Well, London, Paris, Pittsfield. Like, it was, like, crazy.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
You know, because you had these people making, like, really good money and on these technologies that were very exclusive to them. But they were also doing horrible things, too. I mean, they polluted everything in the area. I mean, transformers, they were using PCBs as the insulator in the oil.
What is that? What's
it's like polychlorinated biphenols, and it's, you know, very hazardous to the environment and wildlife and humans, cancer causing, all this stuff. And what they were doing was just, you know, they would be sent back transformers and equipment that had blown or whatever else, and they were just opening up the equipment and just dumping the PCB oil into the river, you know, and the oil spilled everywhere, and the PCBs went everywhere, and the floors of the factory buildings were dirt. And so, you know, once a year they would scrape the dirt out and then just go dump it, like, all over the place.
Like,
and then
in The Simpsons movie?
Yeah, it's... Yeah. Well, they were, like, need landfill, and they were, you know, dumping it in people's yards throughout the county, you know, and beyond. They didn't even know where it all was. So from Pittsfield to the Atlantic Ocean, the Housatonic River is polluted with PCBs that originated in Pittsfield. And they were just dumping the stuff. There's a little pond, like, in town called Clear Lake. I mean, the lake at one point caught on fire. You know, the lake was burning. The lake just burned for a while. Yeah, the lake, what's the smoke? Oh, the lake's burning. You know.
Is that a natural occurrence now? Or
No.
Or just at that time?
At the time, the lake burned. And when I moved here, it wasn't until, like, the first several years I moved here, that thing didn't freeze over in the wintertime because of the alkaline content of the water. I mean, it didn't freeze.
It's crazy shit what we do to the environment.
And they knew it all. I mean, there's another, GE is still huge over in, like, Albany or Schenectady. It's still there.
What is that? Is that the town? Is that like a, that's not the City of Lights, is it?
City of Lights?
Is it?
Yeah.
Because I remember seeing a GE building.
Yeah, there's a huge GE sign.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, two stories tall, and they change it to green and red for Christmas, like all this stuff. But you know, they're still a big force there. But they were also in Albany, and they dumped PCBs there, and they did a cleanup there at the Hudson River. Did a much better job than what they did in the Housatonic. The Housatonic, they just walked away from it. And the problem is, you know, they still, I don't know, people are out of their minds. Like, when I moved here, what happened was the PCB thing happened. Jack Welch, they knew about it. They actually discovered, like, about a year ago, all this correspondence of them covering up the PCBs in the 60s because there was no EPA. Nixon created the EPA. But the government was like, yeah, we kind of need to know about, like, this stuff because we heard it's bad. And there was all this cover-up of, like, to keep the government away from looking at this stuff because, you know, self-regulating industry and, you know, whatever. And they totally knew this stuff was bad when they were dumping it in there. I got a vacuum cleaner. But
they do not fuck around here.
Yeah, with getting stuff.
Yeah.
We're cleaning up.
Yeah.
I don't think it'd be that bad.
No.
Until she starts banging into the door of it. So that happened, and it was in that time, starting in the 70s, you know, well, what happened in the 70s? People look at, well, Detroit and all that kind of stuff. That wasn't the only place where they were, you know, shutting down industry and trade deals were happening.
And how did that happen here? Like, what made the decline? Like, why, what did this building across the street used to be? What was Mass Mocha?
Yeah, it used to be Sprague Electric.
And so that was Sprague Electric.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The industry, what happened? Why did it deteriorate?
Oh, they outsourced, they moved it all overseas starting in the late 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, they, like, oh, we can make this over there. You know, we can make this over there. We can make that over there.
And what does that do? What is, like, from your perspective, what does that do to towns like these? Oh,
just totally devastation. I mean, you know, GE employed 25,000 plus people, and every other business was dependent upon GE. They were all servicing GE or the people who worked for GE in the houses and families and everything. And GE, you know, because they controlled the town, wouldn't, you know, if some other company came by, it's like, well, it seems like there's educated workers here, you know, that we could put our own plant in, something like, no, we're not going to give you building permits. I mean, they ruled the town and prevented people, other industries, from coming in. Like, this is, we want to say what happens to everybody here. And they just prevented any competition from coming in. So there was no diversification of the economy. One company leaves, well, that's it, you know? And so, I mean, that was in the early 80s when that happened. I mean, it was total devastation, you know. I mean, people, you know, it totally destroyed the economy in the area. And then, but they did, GE was here until like 2004 still, because since between that time, they had their plastics division was based in Pittsfield, you know. And if you've ever seen The Graduate, you know, he said, plastics is where it's at, boy, plastics. Mm-hmm. He's talking about Pittsfield, GE in Pittsfield, because that was still very profitable for like another almost 30 years, like another 25 years. They did all their research there for plastics. Plastics were kind of invented in Pittsfield. So that was another business that they had, but that was a fraction of their overall business, you know, okay. that they were doing there. So Sprague, it was the same thing. They just moved, like, oh, we can make this in China. We can do this in China. We can do that in China. And
just with no consideration of the people that made it.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Made it what it was.
GE wouldn't exist today to this moment if it wasn't for Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
I mean, as an international company. And so this is, coming back full force on, and this is the most infuriating thing. You know, I'm not from here. I don't have that kind of history. It's just so obvious when you come in.
Yeah.
You know, and you still have these, I don't hear them anymore. Maybe they all croaked, but you'd go to city council meetings and you'd have these old timers get up and get on the mic and like, what we need is the return of good manufacturing jobs to Pittsfield. It's like, okay, if you want the job, go to China and like commit a crime, and then your job is in a Chinese prison over there. That's who's making GE products. Yeah. And these other, that's who they contract to mm-hmm. make their stuff, is like, you know, Chinese labor, prison labor, and whatever else. That's where it is. And the most disgusting thing is that what's happening is GE is moving its headquarters to Boston. They were given a $155 million taxpayer dollar deal. Mm-hmm. So like $25 million from Boston itself, and the other $130 million from the state. So you live in the Berkshires, you live in Pittsfield, your tax dollars are subsidizing GE's headquarter build out in Boston.
Mm.
And I mean, it's like the most, it's like, what? And they, you know, they still haven't cleaned up the town and the river. You know, they did some cleanup, but that was mandated back in the 80s that they had to do the cleanup, and they still haven't done it. So for 30 years, their lawyers have been fighting the government to properly clean up their mess.
And they still won't do it.
And they still won't do it.
That's like almost like the shit in Flint. Like, it's just ridiculous. It's like,
you. I mean, our water is good. Like, that's no issue for us. We have like Pittsfield has the best water
area, but I went to the movies at the Movieplex in North Adams, here in North Adams, and there was a Stella Artois commercial about if you buy this limited edition Stella glass, you get water, you get help water, people get water in third world countries. And I'm like, what the fuck about Flint?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's right here.
Right.
Like, it's not, like, I'm not an activist. It just seems like you would just do this. Do you think it's because regulations, it's easier to get that done overseas and to help a bunch of people as opposed to like trying to do something here?
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
States?
You know, yeah, it's a very,
it's less red tape maybe.
Yeah. There's, you know, the problems are identifiable and you can address them. This country, it's all for profit, all for business. I mean, the whole Flint thing happened because there was a contract, like Flint could have got their water forever from Detroit. Mm-hmm. There was no reason not to keep getting their water from Detroit.
Yeah.
But there was a government, state contract to build a water pipeline that's, I don't know how many miles long,
mm-hmm.
and was a huge contract to these private corporations that's where they were going to get their water from to do that. And, you know, so forth. That's why that happened. And that's why they went off of Detroit water. And then just, you know, because that's a business-friendly governor and administration is why that happened. And it's all for profit, all for business, all the time. And, like, you know, we see it, you know, like the other, that stuff happens. Walmart comes in. That's another thing that happens. North Adams, I mean, when I come up here and do comedy, you know, I'll... A fun thing to go back to is to talk about the Walmart. They have the biggest Walmart I've ever seen.
Is it?
In just south of town.
I kind
of it is. Now. It is. I'm like, it's more square foot per capita, you know, for a town the size of North Adams, and Adams is the neighboring town.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another Walmart down in Pittsfield. You know, there's, it's not like the one up here is the only one.
Is there, because there's one, I went to the one in Albany. It was the first time I saw one that had two floors.
Ooh, I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's that big one here, but it's big. It's like, why is this thing here? It's so huge. It makes no sense for the population,
mm-hmm.
and all it does. You know, if you walk downtown in North Adams,
I saw
empty storefronts. You know, there used to be a toy store. There used to be a hardware store. There used to be, like, since I lived here, there used to be those things. Mm-hmm. Walmart opened, and those things are gone.
Like 16 years ago.
No, I mean,
when did you move? I moved here.
Yeah, 2001.
Okay.
Yeah,
15 years ago. Yeah.
And those, even then, those things had survived all, you know, the economic turmoil.
Yeah.
But then a Walmart comes in, and boom, they're gone.
It's so, you know, it's
so stupid.
It's fucked up. And it's like, how do I negotiate that when it's like, because I used to work there. I worked there like the summer before my senior year.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to get a stereo. I mean,
right,
you know.
Right, sure.
So you're 21 years old. You want the fucking Pioneer stereo with the dolphin swimming in.
Sure.
Take a girl out to the movies.
Nice.
But, it's because it's like what they do, like they, the way that they treat the employees, the way, but it's like, man, I can't believe what the fuck they're doing. And it's like, how much is these, are these paper towels?
Yeah.
Like, and it's so cheap.
Right, right. And, but what's disgusting is, I mean, I worked for like a sporting gear manufacturer.
Okay.
And we looked at like deals with Walmart and how you would get into a system that big and how they dictate how much your product is going to cost them, mm-hmm. versus like, what? No, it costs this much. We need to make some kind of profit. You know, they dictate the cost of the products that they will sell. Like that is how it works. But the fact is that they are a total leech on the system. I mean, they you know, the employees have to be on, you know, WIC and have government subsidized health care and all that, you know.
They have to be on WIC?
Well, I mean, when you sign up, when you become an employee now, you're given the sheets of like, here's how to sign up for WIC, here's all that, because we're not paying you enough to
give you the forms
of to go to you know, leech off the system. And in Massachusetts, you know, how they spread throughout the state is they went from town to town and said, hey, let us build this Walmart. You know, it'll probably knock out, we acknowledge it's going to knock out some local businesses, but we're going to have this many jobs, we're going to have this many more jobs, and you're going to get property taxes on the property, because in Massachusetts, you paid, if you have a store, you pay tax not only on the physical building, but there is a tax on the goods in the store, mm-hmm. right? So if you have, you know, whatever, $10 million worth of products in your store, there's a tax on that as well, right? So they're like, you will get this revenue now, because we're going to have this many goods here. So they spread throughout the state, and then they went to the state house and said, we don't want to pay this tax anymore. We employ X thousand people in your state, and you better cut a deal with us, or we're going to start shutting things down. So then at the state level, they cut the taxes. For any business that has X goods, only for Walmart.
Only Walmart.
Only for Walmart. Yeah. So the local businesses that survived the Walmart appearing, you know, which they already had huge advantages, Walmart does, you know, just the volume and the corporate infrastructure around it and supply and all that kind of, but now they pay less taxes than you as a smaller, it's like totally insane. And the towns that cut the deal for the Walmart to be there in the first place, now they don't get the revenues that they were promised, you know, so because, you know, it's so corrupt and disgusting, you know, I mean, it's the worst. So, I mean, I joke here. It's like, well, hey, last time I was here, you guys had a toy store. Now it's, you know, then Walmart expanded. No more toy store.
Like, did they like it?
The biggest wall. Like, I said, I get it. I understand what's going to happen because, you know, because you come into town and it's all dark. The idea is you guys are just going to, the whole town is, you're just going to move into the Walmart. The cheesy poofs are there. You know, everything is there, the diapers, it's all there, and it's big enough that you guys can all just move in. Like, that's the idea. I see, it's a brilliant plan, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
The town, you know, your city leaders that said, sure, build the Walmart, sure, expand it, you know, like, that was the goal. That's where You guys are headed. It's so smart because it's, you know, it's a very great idea.
Now, where do we get this brain of yours, Tom? Where did it start for you?
Oh,
like,
cause
you being like this kind of, I don't know how to describe you. I like you. I mean, you know what I mean. But like you have like a. How do I say it? Like you're very like political minded,
right?
And
right.
How do you get there? Where does it start for you? Is it in North California? Is that where you?
Yeah, Northern California is where I'm from. I'm from California, kind of like in general, like and like Hollywood and Pasadena, and then Northern California, and yeah, it was a great. It was growing up in the 70s out there. I think what happened for me was in the 70s, when I was going to school, I was going to public school, and they passed this law that called Proposition 13, which essentially defunded schools completely. So what it did was it put this weird cap on property taxes, because people were like, I don't want to pay more property tax for some school. And this baby boom had happened, where like it was just bizarre growing up in our neighborhood. I had friends, but they would be, you know, it was very suburban living, but you didn't have a friend on your block, you know, the entire block of however many hundred houses. He was a few blocks away, so there weren't a lot of kids. I mean, everybody knew everybody, but you were really spread out.
What town is it?
This is like Menlo Park, California, near Stanford University and all this stuff. And so you had these older people who lived there. Their kids were already maybe in, you know, a few were still in college, but most of them, the kids were gone. So it was older people. And we had shit happen to us. Like, we'd be walking around in a group. We're like, hey, look, everybody's here. Like, five of us, you know, like the five kids from the whole area. And, you know, we'd be going off to like play baseball at the school grounds, or something like that. And these people would call the police, you know, like we weren't doing anything. They're like, there's no kids here. What are these kids doing? Like, cause there weren't kids there. And then, you know, you never saw children. It was just the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
But we had these schools and they didn't want to see, they didn't want to pay any more property tax to fund the schools. Right. So what happened was there was literally a school, two schools over the wall from my house. You know, one was an elementary school, one was a middle school. And it was like literally overnight this law passed and I couldn't go to the school. I couldn't walk to school. I had a 3-minute walk to school.
Mm-hmm.
School boarded up. They boarded the school up and you got on a bus an hour and 15 minutes each way to go to school.
Wow.
All because they had enough money to open one school. We went from classrooms that had like 12, 15 kids to 35 kids in these rooms. Like it was, and you just this convoy of buses to this one school, you know, kids like
they, what
you know,
city like, is that? What town is that?
That was down in Portola Valley is where this main school was.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, you know, you're putting like little kids, kindergartners and first graders. They don't understand. Oh, I'm going to be on a bus for an hour. They're pissing themselves because they just got up and had their orange juice. They're like, oh, my school is like 5 minutes away. No, it's an hour and 15 minutes.
Holy shit.
Okay, yeah. So kids are on the bus for 2.5 hours a day to, you know, because they could only open the one school.
Why did they do that again?
Because it capped people's property taxes. People didn't have to, like, oh, I don't, you know, and reduced them, actually. It cut them down and then kept it at that level. That's why schools in California are total, I mean, if I was in California with my family and I couldn't live in certain exclusive neighborhoods, which I don't know how I'd be able to afford it, you have to put your kid in private school. The school, because the public schools are just horrific, you know, they've been terrible for over 25 years, you know, it's just been a mess. So that had a real effect on me, seeing like, oh, they passed a law that totally, you know, disenfranchised this whole generation of kids and the subsequent ones because of rich, greedy people.
Was this when you were a kid or when you were like
a... This is when I was a kid, yeah,
so
yeah.
So you had to go, you had to do the busing.
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah, I was in the bus, you know, back and forth, you know.
Smelling like piss all over.
Yeah, it was just like what, you know, kids are, you know, and some of them, I mean, circuitous routes on the bus to get to all the kids to go there, and, you know, kids are throwing up because you're in the top of this bus swaying back and forth, and it was just a total horror show.
Jesus Christ.
the schools were right behind our house. Okay, if there's fewer, I understand there's a lower population of students, but okay, then you shut off a wing of the school, like, you know, you consolidate the rooms you're going to use at the school, but you don't just, oh, we're sending everybody to one school across this whole area. You know, it was really, really awful. So, you know, I ended up going to a private school after that, and I did work study. So I worked at the school to pay for my tuition at like a Jesuit high school.
Okay.
Junior and for what do you call it? Middle, junior high, junior high school.
What did your mom and dad do?
My dad was a civil engineer. Uh-huh. And my mom she worked in the for child welfare department, like a county job, and then worked in the court system. She was a court clerk.
Would that the first job, was that like hands on or was it more an admin type stuff?
Oh, it was more administrative. Like it was mainly like a huge part of her job was child support, kind of.
Making sure people made their payments.
Making sure payments or just keeping track of things.
Yeah.
Because there was like, you know, in that situation, there's corruption both ways. Like,
yeah.
Dads who don't pay, sure. and moms who have other sources of income who are just trying to get as much money from the dad, like,
yeah,
as possible. That has nothing to do with the welfare of the child.
It's crazy. There was this story recently. This woman in the Bronx left her kid at home so she could go strip.
Right, right.
Did you hear about that story?
Yep.
And it's like, and then the family of the kid and the baby's father was just like, I don't know what happened. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, where the fuck were you guys?
Right.
When
right.
she was trying to, you know, make money. I mean, who judge if you want about the stripping.
Yeah.
I'm not going to judge a woman for doing that because there's somebody paying for the shit.
Right, sure.
But, like, she leaves the kid. That was obviously neglect. But it's like, right, you had all these people that are crying on TV.
Right.
Where were you for the kid? Like, do you really care about this kid as much as you say you do?
Right, right. Or you're just scandalizing things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, I have a friend who's going through, like, just this, you know, he's a dad, and he's just going through this horrific thing with trying to see his child. And, you know, I understand that 100 years ago, okay, this welfare system was set up, you know, that child support and that kind of thing happened because, you know, men would go into a town and they shack up with the lady and, yeah, let's get married or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's a kid and they're like, I kind of am not into this.
And they leave.
They would just leave. And like, what, you know, and that 100 years ago, that was a real problem.
Yeah.
You know, with that and you know, they didn't have social security cards and they couldn't track where people were to hold people responsible.
And the dude's like down the street, he just doesn't come.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I understand the origin of that and also how, you know, of course, you know, it's still a topic to get today that women don't make as much per hour as men, you know, and that, you know, that were prevented or blocked out of certain jobs that men were. It's still an issue today, but mm-hmm. I can't imagine 100 years ago how totally devastating that was.
Yeah.
It would be for people and for families. But it's much more equitable today. There are systems by which to track things.
Right.
But the laws and the attitude haven't come back to a more central position between the two parties, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So even in Massachusetts, a progressive and liberal state, everything is totally skewed towards the mother. Like 100% of like well, by default, she would get custody. And by right. default, it's you have to convince, you have to have overwhelming evidence to not just have the mother not be the default custodial parent. You have to have all this evidence just to get some partial time with the kid. Mm-hmm. You know, that you have the rights to have time with your children.
For a guy that actually wants to be yes. in his kid's life, yeah.
It's completely at the deference of the mother, you mm-hmm. know. It's totally up to her unless you have some kind of overwhelming evidence otherwise. And my yeah. friend, I mean, you know, he loves his daughter. The mother is, you know, she has a record and she's constantly, you know, she's a drunk driver and just all these totally kind of scary, irresponsible stuff. You know, he's never missed a child support payment. He has done everything to spend every possible minute. He's never missed times to be with his kid. You know, yeah. like, oh, I'm going to go off on vacation or whatever.
Yeah.
And like a year ago, January, the mom just stopped appearing with the kid, like for the pickup time.
Hmm.
And he didn't see his daughter for like 11 months and almost exactly a year. And the mom took off with the kid out of state. I mean, all this stuff is totally, you know.
They couldn't track her. Did they track her down?
She took the kid to Florida. And then there were pictures of the kid not with any relatives. And the mom, like, with just other people. And the mom was just gone, like, gone. And all this kind of, you know, and I mean, it was noted he went to the court over and over again, and I mean, I don't have all the details myself, but just from you know, talking to him and knowing what's going on, you know, she missed countless court dates.
Mm-hmm.
It was noted that she took the kid out of state. If a guy takes a kid out of state, it's Amber Alert time.
Oh yeah,
you know. But she took the kid. Nothing. Yes, it's a violation of all the agreements and whatever. Sure.
That's some low-key Dear Zachary shit.
Right, yeah.
You see that, Doc?
Yes.
That's fucking brutal, yes. dude. Oh, my God.
So, my poor friend, I mean, he you know, got back, you know, after she missed all these court dates, you know, her attorney peers were like, well, the father's abusive, so that's why she's yeah. doing this. Like, what is the evidence of it? And he had to go... My friend had to go through all this psychological evaluation with, you know, subjected to all this stuff and background yeah. check, which he'd already done before.
Mm-hmm.
No evidence of anything, whatever. So, I mean, the only way, and even with all this stuff, all the violations,
mm-hmm.
the missing court dates and everything, he's still the one. He gets supervised visitation at a center, like a community center, with a person sitting and watching him with his daughter yeah. the whole time.
That's like, you know, like the B story of Southpaw.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I didn't want to sidetrack there, but I wanted to do more. So, but it's a thing. It's yeah.
so crazy, you know, yeah. when you see that kind of like, so like that
the injustice of
yeah from law. Like, so that's law. Why I'm kind of always sensitive. Like, well, yeah. what is this person's perception of this, like economically, and what is their, you know.
Right. So is that pretty much what informs your comedy?
And well, yeah,
in,
I mean,
in a way,
I try to my comedy. God, I didn't even. I mean, I started. I've only really been doing it solidly for about 4 years, but I've always been a fan. I try to put some kind of surrealist things in there. I try to talk about. You know, it is very subjective. I'm not such a observational kind of person. I will, you know, I've some stories. God, I don't even know how to describe what I do, because when I started, I kind of did some shock value stuff, like, oh, am I getting reactions from things, and
yeah.
and talked about sex things more, but I really don't do that at all anymore, you know?
I guess it's just like an evolution. We were talking backstage about, you know, comics trying to be like Bill Hicks or trying to be right. Louis or Burr. Right. And it's like, well, it's like, you know, like Louis has a rape joke and it worked.
Right.
But like this is a guy that's been doing it 20 plus years. He's a Jedi.
Yeah.
But sure. He had to start from somewhere. Like right. He had to have like the kernel, just because it's not a Louis C.K. bit doesn't yeah. mean that you can't try your own.
Right.
I mean, but it's, you know, you'd be under less scrutiny because you don't have a TV show that somebody could
sure
try to take.
Well, I mean, you know, like when I host with my open mic, you know, I try to tell the comics who are just starting out. I mean, there's people like, oh, it's their second time ever doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, you know, just try to be yourself. Don't,
yeah.
you know, you really might think this is a great dead baby joke, but, you know, I guarantee you that Anthony Jeselnik has about a
much better one than
200
you.
200 better dead yeah. baby jokes than you do, and you're going to somehow break his, you know, stranglehold on the perfect dead baby joke. You're yeah. not going to do it, and nobody learned anything about you from it.
Right.
You know, so why are you doing that?
Yeah, it's almost like, what kind of comic do you want to be? Like, do you can be like, because I'm inspired by, I mean, the, like when I was a kid, it was more like I love Chris Rock, I like Paul Mooney, all the greats, but like Martin Lawrence was my guy,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
mainly because he was from my hometown area, and he was a superhero to me. Like I thought he was cool, and then as you grow and you start, it's like I'm nothing like that guy, but there's something about you can tap. My dad always told me, like with sports, if you see a player that you like.
Mm-hmm.
Try to do what they do, like try to take some of an aspect of their game
yeah.
and bring it to you. So what does me showing vulnerability like Martin Lawrence used to do,
mm-hmm.
what is that like with me? How do I in turn, like it's all like all of your experiences are cut with your childhood, like Burr would say. Mm-hmm. And it's just mm-hmm. what makes your this is a Chris Lambert dick joke as opposed to
right,
a
right.
Louis dick joke.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So it's like that. That's kind of, because it's almost like you can't say anything. Everything's pretty much been said already.
Yeah, yeah. But certainly.
But
yeah.
it's like, how do you make it your own?
Right.
So I think that's the
well, it's
struggle,
very,
the struggle and the fun. The
yeah,
fun, yeah.
It's very, you know, I like, you know, I mentioned my dad earlier. He's I mean, he was a total psychopath. Like he was.
Is he still alive? Or?
I don't know. I think he is.
Shit! You didn't have a relationship with him? Or?
No, he was. When I left to go to college, mm-hmm. I mean, he had been behaving really violently and crazy for like the last 7-8 years I was in the house.
Okay.
Know? And but my mom wouldn't leave him. You know, it was just like. She just exposed me to this like incredibly violent, crazy person. You know, who abused me and. I mean, he was just a total piece of shit.
Mm.
I mean, psychologically, I kind of understand how it happened to him, but that's no excuse.
Sure.
You know, he was an adult, and he should have known what he was doing, you know. And, I mean, he was just, like, later, like, in further examination, like, oh, the thing he keeps talking about killing, that's me, you know. You know, he was saying when I was a little kid, like, if I could kill him and get away with it, I would do it. Like he would say that, and it took me years to figure out. Like, oh, he was talking about killing me, jeez. You know, because he just didn't want to deal with any of this, you know, stuff.
Was that something that you suppressed, or you probably you didn't know it was you at all?
Yeah, I didn't really associate. Oh, he's talking about killing me.
And when did that light switch go off?
Probably like when I was in junior high.
Oh, shit, so like 12, 13?
Yeah, when, like, he, like, this one day, he just, like, decided to beat me, like, with his fists for, like, a day. Like, he came home from work, like, early, and like, oh, what's going, and then he just started to beat me up, like, all day long. Like, he didn't break my nose, but, like, I, like, you know, I had double black eyes, and, you know, was...
What?
Yeah, he just beat me for a whole afternoon. You know, and
nobody did anything.
Yeah, my mom saw me and was just like, "What are you doing? He had hit me all the time anyway. You know, and you know, had like whipped me with things and all that kind of stuff. But this one day, I was just like, "Oh, he could like." When I was getting hit in the face like over and over again with a fist, I'm like, "Oh, this could kill me." You know, jeez. Like what the fuck,
dude? I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, when I went off to school, I came back, and I came back like at Christmas. I moved my mom out of the house, like my freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. And I saw him there, and I found out like he had been like, he had never physically abused her. That was the thing. He would psychologically abuse her, but he had never abused her physically before. But I caught him like shaking her, and like I was like, oh, it's on. And he ran away. Like, he ran out of the... Like, got in his car and drove away. And he called the police. And the police came, and they're like, yeah, something happened. Like, you know... It's like, oh, I'm moving my mom out of the house. And I discovered, like, he has been, like, physically abusing her and shaking her and you know, that kind of thing.
So were you finally bigger than him at that time?
Yeah, I got...
Was he a big guy?
No, he wasn't. I mean, I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Like, well, through high school. I grew, like, another, like, 5 inches in college.
Okay.
You know? So, like, I don't know, like, maybe it was, like, psychological or psychosomatic response to being, like, abused and put down like that for so long.
Yeah.
Because he's only 5'6". And shit. I was shorter than that up until, like, my maybe senior year of high school. I'm 6 foot now, just over 6 foot tall.
Yeah.
But when I was his size, I think he grabbed me once to, like, well, I don't know what he was going to do, hit me or something like that. And I just turned my arm and it broke his grip. And he went like, oh, like, whoa. Like,
can't fuck with him anymore.
You know, what was going on? And I told his sister moved to this country from Hungary as well. He's Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
And he had banished her. He had done horrible things to her, too. Like, just cut her out of our lives. Even after bringing her over to this country, so she's by herself. It's just a horrible person, right?
Jesus Christ.
And she was like, well, you know, I'm concerned about this. And I'm like, well, my concern is, like, if I start to hit him, I'm never going to stop hitting him. Like, I will just hit him until I don't know what happens. Like, the authorities come and there's, you know, there's just hamburger on the ground. Like, that's what I've... that's what I feel if I start do it, I will never stop. Like,
sure.
It will just keep going on.
Jeez.
And that's what bothers me. And she's like, oh, you know, like that. So I talked to him on the phone in like 1992, but that's the last time I've ever had any interaction.
And so you don't know what he's...
I have no idea. Yeah, I mean, I have relatives. I have cousins, Hungarian cousins, who've come over and stayed with me and my family, and they're like, yeah, we've seen him, you know, but I have no interest, you know, in it.
I don't blame you.
You know, it's like, well, this guy was trying to destroy me, like, psychologically, and, you know, had thought about physically destroying me, you know, and vocalized it. Like, you can, you know, you can have weird, bizarre thoughts, but then to say them out loud and then say them over and over again for like years, like, okay, what is, you know, like that, those are different levels of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a bit anti-authoritarian, you know, because of that.
Okay.
You know, I was a punk, you know, was in punk bands, enjoyed that kind of thing.
So that was your release.
Yeah. Was doing that kind of thing and, you know, played music for a long time, but also comedy was a big release too, because when I could figure out the train schedule, I would take trains up to San Francisco from the peninsula, and this is in the like mid 80s, and I would win tickets on the radio from the station called The Quake, which doesn't exist anymore, but they had this morning show with Alex Bennett, and you know, the cavalcade of comedians that were in San Francisco at that time was unbelievable.
Who was there?
So I could go up, I would call in, I'd get free tickets. Like, I could get free tickets.
Was it Cobb, Punchline, or what was there?
The Cobb wasn't there yet. The Punchline was there, but then there was the Other Cafe, which is where I went most of the time, and the Holy City Zoo.
Okay.
And both of which are gone. And they were both tiny. So, like, the Holy City Zoo... Like, where I do my open mic now is bigger than the Holy City Zoo.
Mm.
And we can get like 60-something people into where I do my mic now. And maybe that's about it's about the size of the Other Cafe. And the Other Cafe was my easier one to get to, because I could take the train to the city and then get on a streetcar. And the streetcar went to, you got out at West Portal right there. You came out of a tunnel and you got out, and the Other Cafe was right there. And if you go there still, the sign is still up on the side of the building for the other cafe. They've kept it. It was this weird box sign that was illuminated, and it was just the other. I think the other, it just said the other on it. And you go in, it was kind of, you know, San Francisco's hilly, so the, it's in a Victorian that's kind of built into the side of the hill, so you were kind of in the half underground room. And I go in, and who would you have there? You'd have Tom Kenny, Bobcat Goldthwait, mm-hmm. Kevin Meaney, Paula Poundstone, all the political guys like Will Durst, Bob Sarlat, you know, Ellen DeGeneres would show up, mm-hmm. Whoopi Goldberg.
Was this the 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mork and Mindy was over, and Robin Williams was back in San Francisco, and Robin Williams would show up in this room just to do a few minutes. Yeah. And
did he tell you that you should be a comic one day?
No, I mean, I did interact with him a couple times.
That's just like a joke that after he died, everybody, he said it, you said I had a good set of time.
No,
you, what were your interactions with him?
Oh, just like, you know, saying hi to him after a set. Like, that was unbelievable. He's like, you were a kid, what are you doing? Like,
that's what he said?
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I was
13?
I was 13, 14 years old, and yeah. I'd go into these places, and they're like, oh shit, what are you doing here, kid? I'm like, I won tickets. And they're like, oh my god. So yeah. They get like the biggest Sharpie that they had and put giant X's on my hand, so like no one would serve me alcohol. And so like that was I tried to make sure like that the X's never completely faded mm-hmm. between times of going up and seeing a comedy show.
Yeah.
You know, because if I could make it up a couple times a month, I would try to do that. I mean, not always successfully, but like you're in these tiny rooms and they're right there and they were working on stuff, you know, all the time.
So that was just like a safe space for you, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. And
get away.
Take the train and down and then ride my bike home afterwards. But yeah, it was those were great times. Who else would be there? Oh God, I'm forgetting. I mean, so many people came out of that scene. Mm-hmm. David Feldman, who's a great writer, Emmy winning writer, and oh God, what's his name from Whose Line Is It Anyway? Tons of those guys from that era and who. From there, like, you know, they're now have been head writers on TV shows. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they're not stand-up performers anymore, but they're behind the scenes and they're creators of a lot of culture that you do see, or now they're producers of stuff that you're watching and enjoying. So that was really a great time to be there to see that kind of stuff, and I really liked it a lot. I never really thought to do it, and I couldn't figure out how I would have done it. Mm-hmm. But that was those were great places. I mean, the Punchline was always kind of a step up, and they had, there are a couple other places that are, they still kind of exist in San Francisco, but a lot of it's gone. I mean, there's some fewer places.
No, like the Purple Onion, is it still there? Mm-hmm. Or is it kind of,
that's always been a weird,
it's like Doc's Lab now, or is it something else?
I don't know. I mean, when I lived in San Francisco, I lived in San Francisco for about 10 years before moving out here.
Were you married to your wife back then?
Not. I met her out there at the very end of my time out there. I was actually going to move to New York, and then I met her. Mm-hmm.
But typical women always changing your life.
Oh, I know. Yeah, seriously.
For the better, though.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm just kidding. but they...
Well, she let you come hang out.
Yeah, oh, well, sure.
She lets you go do shows and stuff.
Yeah, well, now, like I have two kids, and they're at they're at the age where I can do that.
And you do, like, I always see on Facebook, you're with them, so you're going to their baseball game. I know on your podcast, you're the producer of My Dumb Friends, which is with Dan St. Germain and Sean Donnelly. They always kid you that you're like a stage dad.
Right.
But you're in, at least you're in your kid's life, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Are you hard on them with baseball, or are you just...
I get on their case to stay on top of, like, practicing and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, you can't talk about baseball if I haven't seen you pick up a ball in 5 days. So you can't, I don't want to hear you talk about baseball. You haven't done anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have a hitting station in the garage and, you know, with a net that they can hit into and that kind of thing. So, you know, I'm always, you know, it's like, oh, well, you, it's right there. You know?
How hard is it to bat? Because this is good. I've never really talked to, and I guess they haven't kicked this up.
Yeah, they're not going to bother you.
Okay. This is interesting because I don't really get to talk to, I mean, I've talked to many, I mean, Verzi's a dad, but his kids aren't at that age yet where, I'll just put it this way. I've seen some documentaries. There's a documentary on Netflix, and I think it's called like Sports Dads or something like that.
Yeah.
Where the parents are just super overprotective.
Mm-hmm.
They're just super intense.
Right.
Because it seems like there's so much more at stake now.
Right.
Like if you have a kid, you're like, okay, he's good. He likes baseball.
Yeah.
So let's get him to the majors, or let's get this
right,
kid.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, you know, on the one hand, I do, sometimes I see some of that in what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's just like, well, when you have a kid that's doing something like, oh, I'm really into this and I really like to do this.
Yeah.
And then they have a performance where they're disappointed in how they did.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, you understand how that happened. Like you never worked on that before and you didn't do this and you didn't educate yourself about that, and you know,
okay,
so that's my thing. It's like, you know, dealing, you know, it's like getting them as prepared as they can for something versus let's just wing it, you know, I'm having fun.
Yeah.
And then like, well, it wasn't a lot of fun for you not to you know, get like, remember how sad you were because you never connected the bat with the ball.
Oh, like, shit.
You know, like, that wasn't, you weren't, that wasn't fun then, right? You know, so if you want to, you know, like, if you want to be prepared, and then you know, like, well, I did my best in terms of preparation.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, versus,
that's
like,
true.
I just kind of showed up, and I didn't hit the ball once, and I was sad and cried about it. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah, because you didn't do anything.
But you're not, like, you know? A dick about it, though. You're not like, well, you didn't fucking practice.
Oh, I've definitely been a dick a few times.
Do you have to fall back? You say, hey, wait, I'm kind of, what I'm this probably isn't helpful.
Yeah, oh, yeah,
this
definitely.
He's going to be in a therapist chair, like, he's going to, you know, be on somebody's couch.
Yeah, I've definitely, like, been like, yeah, I, you know, just, you did what you could, you know, like, I've figured out a much better balance
of okay.
that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
You know, my daughter, like, my son swims and hates it, but he needs to do something during that time of year.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, because there's so little physical education in schools now, and so little free time in the school just to get out and run around. It's just like, okay, you need to be doing something physical.
Yeah.
You know, 1.5 to 2 hours a day, 4 days a week. Like,
yeah.
you cannot just play video games and
right.
whatever. You need that in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been like, if you want to do soccer, you want to do lacrosse, you want to do whatever, and that's not, and during the baseball season, you'd figure it out. And he never comes up with anything. His sister swims, and like, well, we get a deal for the second kid swimming, so that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to take you to this, and then, you know. So, and she's a great swimmer. Like, next weekend, we're going to the New England Swimming Championships for every year she swam, we've gone to the New England Championships.
So
she's qualified.
What's that like? Like, being, like, you're proud of your kid, but then you also kind of want her to win, right? You wanted to kill that shit, right?
Yeah, I mean, she's had a weird season. And I know it's the coaching because I'm just like, what is the coach doing? This doesn't make any sense. Because I swam for years.
Are you like a parent that's like, if the coach is fucking up, do you say something if you feel like it, or do you just kind of hang back?
Well, what we'll do is there's another kind of, we'll go get her a private lesson with somebody else in the area.
Okay.
Who's a lot more qualified and experienced.
Yeah.
But we, you know, geographically we're limited with certain options. I mean, there's kids that she swam with in another club further south, because it was better at the time, that they go to swim practice 5 days a week, 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an hour and 15 minutes each way, you know,
like the buses.
But yeah. They're doing, and you know, it's, hey, we're in the Northeast. It's dark. They're in the pitch black with a flashlight trying to do their homework because they're in a car for 2.5 hours a day, 5-6 days a week. You know, and I'm just like, I don't want to subject her to that.
Are they trying to go to the Olympics or something?
Well, I mean, a couple of them have been very successful and made it to nationals. You know, and it's just like, wow, that's kind of intense. But on the flip side, what else are they doing? You know, like my daughter, she's a musician and she also plays softball where she's great. She's a great softball player and she likes to, you know, she has interests beyond swimming. She'd like to be as competitive as possible in swimming. It's just that, you know, we have definitely have like kind of hit a block with like coaching ability on this, and it's a little frustrating.
It just seems like nowadays, like kids have so much more. There's so much more pressure on them now.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely put some pressure on her because, again, she's the one that's disappointed. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, you haven't hit your times on these things. You know where your times are here. You know where they're there. And, you know.
How old are we talking?
She's 13.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like, you know where, what would have to be done for that. And you know, again, I'm not the coach at the pool where it's like, okay, to achieve that goal, this is what you would have to do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like the coach, she gets a small stipend. She's another parent.
Okay.
You know, she's nice, but she has hit, you know, like her limit of her abilities on certain things.
She can only do so much.
Yeah. And it's just like, well, what do we do from here? We're up near Williamstown here in North Adams where Williams College is. And they have a swim team up here where the coach is a Olympic swimmer. Like, I don't know if she was a gold medalist, but she medaled in the Olympics and very capable, etc. But we looked at it. She swam with them. They invited her to be on the team, but it's like several hundred dollars a month, you know, and they don't, it's weird, you pay a lot of money, but they don't go and do meets, which is like, I don't understand. Like, you're just there to swim good in the pool at practice. So, you know, you get better by
competing,
you know? Yeah. And so it's a weird, we're like, we don't understand your philosophy, you know?
Because I guess this would be the time, like she's 13.
Right.
It's almost time to, like, lock it down, like, if you want to take it to the next level, right?
Yeah. So we're, like, you know, I told her, she's at the, you know, it's age grouped. So she's in the 13 to 14 age group. And so her first season here, she only qualified in a few events for the championships. Whereas last year, when she was 12, you know, she qualified in like 8 things, you know, and then they limit you to the stuff. And she's like, well, I know I didn't qualify for more things, but like, it's not that you didn't qualify. You actually, some of her times, she didn't improve on them, not to qualifying time, but like, you have all these times, like you haven't swam that fast since you were 12. Mm-hmm. Like, so what, we got to figure this out. So she's a little nervous about it and frustrated, but she's faster. She's 13. She's in 8th grade. Mm-hmm. She's faster than any of the girls who are on the high school team, seniors, you know, at her high school.
Wow.
So, but at the same time, I know that she's not top 10 ranked in any of her events.
How does that make you feel, Tom? They're going to kick me out.
Let's see. Just say we'll be out in a
few. Hello? Hi. It's like, we just wanted to know if you needed any help.
Oh.
Like, I got to get the fuck out of here.
But it's you know, I want things to be good for her.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's just like, okay, well, if you really wanted to do it, I mean, she could get on any of these swim teams in the area that she wanted.
Yeah.
But it's like, if you really wanted to do that, that means like the family, you're driving you 2.5 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
That means like no more band. That means no softball in the off season. You know, which she's also very good at.
Mm-hmm. She's got to start making decisions.
You know, it's like, if that's what you want to do, or we try to figure things out here better, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe there'll be a coaching change, maybe something, you know. You know, or we try the Williamstown thing, and we do meets independently or something like that, but that's still hundreds of dollars a month. So I don't know what, I don't know where we're going to be with it. So it's, I feel for her, but she also has to be the one that really wants to commit and do it, and understand that there might be some sacrifice. I mean, she's also like an honors roll student.
Yeah.
And she's going to, be on all honors classes freshman year and an AP course as a freshman.
Jesus.
And it's just like, what is the balance between all those things?
Yeah.
Because I don't know that you could be an AP student, trying to read stuff by flashlight, several months out of the year in a car.
Right.
Like, that seems... I don't think you could
do
that. That's
brutal. You got to have a life.
And be happy, So
yeah.
Between that, and being a multi-sport athlete, I think that's also important as well, if you want to do that. My son, he's pretty good at school.
Is he younger?
He's 11, yeah.
Okay.
He's not like an honor roll student by any means, but, he's B's and A's.
Yeah.
I
was like that.
He's a good ball player. He likes baseball. Like, that's his favorite sport. But, sometimes it's 11. Like, you're going to go hit for, I don't really, it's not that interesting.
What do you, when I was his age, or around that age, maybe around your daughter's age, I used to go to the batting cage with my dad.
Yeah.
And after that, we would go to Fuddruckers.
Oh, there you go.
And that would be the thing. And wanted to go for Fuddruckers.
Yes. Yeah, he'll go out. He's still a good guy. Take a bucket and go hit a few buckets. Because we've hosted baseball players for the local... we have a collegiate summer league team in Pittsfield. Uh-huh. And we've hosted players, and the last player we hosted... Great kid, Frank Cronella, and he got drafted by the Orioles.
Oh, wow.
So he's in the Orioles organization. But, super nice kid. He comes by, visits us. He comes by just to visit us a couple times a year.
Nice.
We checked out his, we went to his parents for Christmas a couple Christmases ago. And you're like, yeah, this is where it happened. They had down this basement. They have a net. And it was just, he also played hockey. And hockey season, hit 100 pucks a day into the crease. Baseball season, 100 balls a day into the net.
So your son knows that it could happen.
Right, right.
Because of that kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's like,
no excuses.
And we went to spring training in Arizona. We've been twice, and he met. It's like, oh, who are we watching on TV? Hunter Pence, we go see the Giants, but we also see the A's, and
that's dope. And so you're a good dad, man.
Yeah, I got him when we went the last time. We got him to. I somehow finagled, just by going to the stadium early, got him to be a bat boy for the A's.
Oh, wow.
And so he was there with all the A's. I mean, he was just with them,
Yeah.
And they're giving him his bat and banging on his helmet. And it's like, these are real guys.
Yeah.
And these are real. And
he had sometimes
we'll talk about, because he talked about what they were saying in the dugout. And then when he went and used the bathroom and what he saw in the bathroom, like, Dad, they have magazines back there in the bathroom. It's very inappropriate. And I'm just like, oh my God, what could it be? Like, what is going on? It's like, yeah, I was just, they're in there. They have these magazines. Sports Illustrated. I was just like, oh, thank God. Like, there, it's so wholesome. The team is so wholesome. Are you kidding me? They had a Sports Illustrated magazine outside the bathroom.
Since we're talking baseball, did you hear that Bryce Harper quote?
Yeah, yeah.
What did you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's one of the great things about baseball is the traditions and the unspoken rule type thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole thing going between Goose Gossage and Joey Bats, Jose Bautista.
Yeah.
And now Bryce Harper. It's like, well, I think Jose Bautista, I didn't think he was doing something that was violating the rules. That was a pinnacle moment of the epic game and struggle.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, Doom, look what I did, you know, which is,
yeah.
that's what
yeah.
Bryce Harper's talking about. It's like, right. I want to be more flamboyant and have the equivalent of, you know, touchdown spikes and, yeah. you know, and all that kind of thing. Like, no, that's a different thing. I mean, Bryce Harper's still a young guy. I mean, funny enough, we saw Bryce Harper on when he was with the Shorebirds, which is a Orioles.
Okay, yeah.
So
yeah.
we saw him play with the Shorebirds. Like, oh, that kid's amazing. And he's just was creaming. It's like, that guy. And then literally, it was that season that he was traded to the Nationals and was, you know, we saw him, and then 4 weeks later, he was on... He was on the Nationals.
We're yeah.
like, what? That was the kid we saw in Delaware, crazy. You know.
Yeah.
Maryland, right over the border from Delaware.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are those guys. I mean, Puig, I'm not just because he's a Dodger, but mm-hmm. there's nothing team-oriented about it. It's about him as the player, as this individual. And that's already kind of a focus of baseball as it is. It's like, okay, here's all your individual stats and your right. performance can be very...
One of the most stat-driven sports.
Very easily monitored yeah. and everything. Live off of that versus I'm going to not, you know, I mean, I'm not going to come down every yeah. pitch. I'm just going to stand with my glove on my hip, you know, and I'm not going to run stuff out. I'm not going to make the effort. And, you know, like, whatever. You know, I mean, he's... How many times do you want to see Gonzalez school Puig in the dugout after, I mean, it's every season multiple times they have to huddle around him like, you've got to do, like, you've got to run that out because,
yeah,
you know.
Well, that's different. Know, like that's like an effort thing, but it's right. almost like because you, it's like just talking about your daughter, her journey, your son's journey. Right. And most people, it's just like that's, it's an emotional game. Like,
right.
like all these games, like basketball, football, and you can't let it out,
right?
That's
right.
the issue that I see. Like, and it's supposed to be entertainment,
mm-hmm.
but the Puig thing with effort, that's yeah. that's a whole nother story. Like, you should be putting forth the effort, but
didn't Harper name check Puig on somebody?
I think the flamboyancy is just, like, he was. I know he talked about Cam Newton.
Yeah.
And, like, but even like he gets his shit for that. You know, Cam got his shit for that too, but. I just kind of feel like on the other side of it, because it's like, oh my God, my like you know, my I had a broken home and I still did this thing and I scored this touchdown in front of millions of people.
Right, right, right.
Oh my God, I want to spike yeah. the ball.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
my, you know, it's like I didn't know how to tie a tie until I was 22. Oh right. my God, you know, I made it.
Right, right, right.
There's got to be some
yeah,
some type of exhale, some type of release.
Right.
So I mean. I don't know. I was just watching UFC last week for the first time, really experiencing it. You know, it's it's emotional. Like, these guys talk shit about each other, and it's sure. just like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's lots. I mean, if you go through history in baseball, you know, there were people like that.
Yeah.
Look at Bill Spaceman Lee. I mean, like, his locker room conversations are legend, and everything he would say and do. We're going to go to this team, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and, you know... And let's talk about feudalism in the Ottoman Empire. Like, you know, we go on these crazy, like,
it's
what?
It's so corporate now. There's, like, just, like, it's so sanitized and sterile.
Right, right.
And there's no, the thing that brings you to the game is, like, they want to keep you out of it. And it's fucking wrong.
Well, I don't know. I mean, look at Hunter Pence. Again, he's one of our favorite players.
Okay.
My Hunter Pence T-shirt last night.
Who does he play with?
He plays with the Giants.
Oh, that's what you were doing with the sequin shirt?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he's crazy. he's a crazy dude.
Yeah.
And he has plenty of personality that he adds to things. And I mean, look at just the Red Sox in general. I didn't grow up with the Red Sox, but they've always been a personality team.
Mm-hmm.
And when have they not been a personality team? I mean, you know. Again, Bill Spaceman Lee was, that's how he got his start. He started, actually, bring it all back, Pittsfield. He played in Pittsfield at the place in town. That used to be a franchise town for the a minor league town for the Red Sox, and you name them. Bill Murray had a Cubs franchise in Pittsfield in the 80s uh-huh. into the 90s. So, you know, there are teams that have that. The Yankees, yeah, it is totally sanitized. And now the Marlins, you know, Don Mattingly is with the Marlins, and now that means no facial hair, no, like, what, why, the Marlins? What, that's that speaks Florida to you? You know, really? I mean, you know, it's totally bizarre.
Right.
You know, that they're doing that, you know, and there are teams that cultivate personality, like the Giants, like the Red Sox, maybe the Pirates, and the Cubs, you know, those are personality teams. So, you know, I think, I don't know, but maybe Harper should get traded to something else. I mean, I also understand his frustration.
Yeah.
You know, of not having a championship yet and being one of the top two players in baseball, you know.
Yeah.
So between him and Mike Trout, it's just the constant, who's the best, who's the best? And neither of them have a ring to show for it.
Right.
Trout seems kind of okay. Like, he can deal with it.
There's so many other variables when it comes to that game.
Yeah. Well, it's a much more... It's so funny because people talk about, oh, in football, anything can happen. But if you look at the stats, it's the same football teams. It's like the rotation and the introduction of a new team into the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
You're lucky to get one into that tier.
Yeah.
But baseball, the Giants won 3 rings, you know, every other year.
Mm-hmm.
That, it's totally insane. My whole life.
Pitching, though.
My whole life. It never happened.
Yeah.
You know, my entire life, the first championship finally happened. And, you know, certainly some teams had a run of it, like the Yankees, like, you know, late 90s. And
well, it's more parity in the NFL and MLB. But basketball, it's only about 3 or 4 teams that are going to win.
Right. Well, and for me, from time in the Bay Area, the freaking... The Golden State Warriors, they were a crap team.
Yeah.
Again, I wasn't there in that kind of mid to late 70s. I was still in L.A. and a kid to even understand what the Warriors did in whatever that was, 1976.
Were you there, Chris Mullin, Tim Hardaway here?
I'd say Chris Mullin was the guy.
Yeah.
Chris Mullin.
Mario Ellie.
Yeah. But, you know, they were garbage. They were total crap.
Yeah.
Like, you would go, we would take BART, you know, the subway system over... Watch a game, like, we saw some basketball, you know? It was just like, let's just watch. We could watch them do some basketball. A's are kind of like that, too, you know, with what they've done and what they've been able to do. But, you know, it's just bizarre, you know, and always has been between, like, as you said, like, it's these few teams where that happens. And baseball, you know, certainly has its problems, but...
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, they're going to have to address them. But, you know, I love they have an actual minor league system for players to come up through versus using colleges and putting everybody in debt to fund the NFL, which is basically what that is, that whole system is. So, we could do that.
We could do that another time.
Yeah.
But we got it. They're going to kick us out.
Cool.
But, dude, this was great. Mm. Where can people find you?
Just follow me on Twitter now. My website is under reconstruction, but at TomDog. Mm-hmm. Is I'm on Twitter and I post, you know, any show that I'm working on or whatever.
And My Dumb Friends.
My Dumb Friends podcast with Dan St. Germain and Sean Donnelly comes out every single week. And I have some other projects in the works, so hopefully some more Bill Burr videos. And I'm working, you mentioned Paul Verzey, I'm working on a movie with him. So hopefully have some things to announce with those.
Cool.
At some point.
But Tom, thanks so much for hanging, man.
Chris, thanks for coming up here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, always a pleasure,
man. We'll have you back soon.
All right. Take it easy, everybody.